Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated.
Good morning. We're delighted to welcome today Iowa Grant High School students. Would they please stand? We're delighted to have you with us today. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program sponsored by this court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. Under the program, high school students are invited to come to the court and hear an oral argument. And if the invitation is accepted, the students got the briefs that counsel filed in this case. And supposedly they read them and they may have done other assignments in connection with this case. Furthermore, the students will stay on this second argument, and if they can, they will meet with a justice of this court who will discuss the procedural aspects of the court taking and deciding cases, not the substantive issues of the case. Let me introduce the members of the court to you all. I'll start on my far left. Justice Lewis Butler. Justice Butler is the justice with whom the students will meet today. Seated next to Justice Butler is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Robinsack. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case today, 04AP2746, Affordable Erecting, Inc. versus, is it Neosho? Trompler, Inc. Robert Myroff will be arguing on behalf of Affordable Erecting. Mr. Myroff.
Good morning, counsel. Good morning, justices. The issue here, as we all know, is was there a settlement precluding the plaintiff from bringing a second suit? And there's two issues under that, namely, was there a settlement under 807.05, and was there a settlement based on estoppel? Concerning 807.05, it's got parts in it which says that the only way to get a settlement in the state of Wisconsin is if you have a settlement either in court that's in the minutes or on the record, or if it's not in court, then the settlement has got to be in writing and subscribed to by the parties. And what that means is that there's got to be something written, and then it's got to be signed by either the party or his attorney. In this case, it wasn't in court, and there was a mediation agreement, but the mediation agreement had a part on the bottom because the plaintiff was not there. So in the mediation agreement, it stated that the mediation agreement would only be valid if the plaintiff approved it by 12 o'clock the next day, which the plaintiff never did.
Can I ask a question on that? What you said is exactly correct. But the fact that the plaintiff didn't sign it, perhaps you can elucidate, they sort of don't, I got the idea they sat on their hands a little bit, obviously changed counsel, but there was, you make the argument in your brief, I think very well, that look, they knew the contingency was there, but I didn't see any action from Affordable or Tracy for a period of time. And that's where the estoppel, I'm talking the equities,
right,
come in.
That is correct. What happened there was that the plaintiff didn't sign the agreement, and then 3 weeks later he apparently told his own lawyer that he agreed to the settlement, but he did that orally, and then the plaintiff's lawyer told the insurance company's lawyer, his own insurer, and then that attorney told Neosho's lawyer, and then they circulated these closing documents, which would have been releases and stipulation in order for dismissal, all of which the plaintiff's attorney and the plaintiff refused to sign. And then I suppose you could say that he didn't. There was more inaction on the part of the plaintiff because the plaintiff didn't say, you know, this is off, we want to litigate it. The plaintiff actually didn't do anything, and then eventually the judge in the case dismissed the case without prejudice, and then I got involved in it, and we started all over again.
So the judge didn't, in other words, from the judicial system, there was just a lack of knowledge. The judge dismissed here was without prejudice, conceding that, but there was a appreciation that at least something had gone on and that there had been an agreement signed, but there was a contingency, and that's what you're hanging your hat on, that was not complete, therefore it does not meet the requirements.
Right. Not only wasn't it complete, but it was, should have been obvious. It's like when you do an offer to purchase and it says this has to be accepted in one day. If it's not accepted, that deal is void. Right. And it's got to be more writing signed to reprise it. So going back to 807s, so if you, it's got to be writing and it's got to be subscribed. And the Court of Appeals, I think, correctly found that verbal assurances do not satisfy the terms of 807.05, and neither do action or inaction satisfy the terms of 805. It's got to be 807.05. It's got to be in writing and subscribed, which means signed by the parties.
Mr. Meyer, yeah. Let me just ask you about the dismissal for a moment. I know the your opposing party raises this in their brief, but under 805.03, shouldn't the dismissal by the trial court have been with prejudice since it was for failure to prosecute?
Well, I did look at the case that they cited, and the case they cited mentioned, like, egregious conduct. And
well, I'm reading right from 805.03. Any dismissal under this section operates as an adjudication on the merits unless the court, in its order for dismissal, otherwise specifies for good cause shown recited in the order, and that there was nothing in the order in this case.
Although there is a due process argument there, because what the court did was it says if you don't respond in 20 days, I'm going to dismiss without prejudice. So then by this argument you're saying that then the court with no response in 20 days could dismiss with prejudice, and it wouldn't be giving fair notice to the plaintiff who, if they said to the plaintiff, if you don't respond, we're going to submit with prejudice, then there would have been more impetus for them to respond. And there's another argument against that, is that this argument wasn't brought up in either the circuit court or in the Court of Appeals, and that there's a due process argument and there was no egregious conduct. And so the judge apparently didn't feel that there was any need to say what conduct made him say it was dismissed without prejudice. I think what happened here was that because the judge was notified that this case was settled and then no papers came in, that the judge simply dismissed it without prejudice, without making any further inquiry. And maybe the answer to your question is that the judge never would have dismissed this case with prejudice or without if he had made the inquiry and found out what was going on. But rather than make the inquiry, he just said, I'll dismiss without prejudice. If this case is dead, it's dead. And if they want to start over again, they can, which we did.
But didn't the notice of dismissal indicate that the matter had not been diligently prosecuted and would be dismissed? So that isn't the judge saying in the, not in the order, but in the notice that the order would be entered, giving the explanation, failure to diligently proceed.
No, but he did say that if you don't answer, I'm going to dismiss this case without prejudice. So I don't see how you can hang your hat on one part of the judge's message, but then disregard the other part of the judge's message.
Which one are you disregarding?
Where he said, I'll dismiss it without prejudice if you don't respond in 20 days.
So he followed through.
And he did dismiss it without prejudice. And we're not quarreling with a dismissal without prejudice.
He says the reason that he's sending out this notice is that you haven't been, someone hasn't been diligent, both of you, in proceeding. Therefore, unless you show that there is diligence in proceeding by responding, he's going to dismiss.
Without prejudice.
Without prejudice.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
And that's what he did.
All right.
And we agree that he had the right to do that.
All right.
And that would give us the right to start over again. Now going to the estoppel argument, the first thing is you have to show justifiable reliance to have estoppel, and we're saying there's no justifiable reliance because the first indication is that these people had to approve within 24 hours, and he did not approve. So therefore, they know they have no agreement. Then the other thing they would hang their hat on is this, like, third-hand verbal assurance that the case is settled. But then they passed out these closing documents, releases, and stipulation in order for dismissal in May and June, right after this mediation, and there was a refusal to sign. So that's more indication that there's no settlement here, not no justifiable reliance.
What about the fact that it was your client that advised the insurance company that the case was settled? And then the insurance company took action dispersing checks based on that. Should we be looking at that?
You should be, and that's one of the things I wanted to get into was the idea that the insurance company has a separate interest than the plaintiff. The insurance company had a $50,000 exposure here because the defendant said that their equipment was damaged to the extent of $50,000. My client purchased like what they would call, it's like malpractice insurance, which they paid a tremendous premium for. And it was that if they damage anything, the insurance company will pay for it. They moved heavy equipment. So when it came time to settle this case in mediation, this insurance company, my client's insurance, they saw a way to get out of a $50,000 claim by paying $12,000. They financed the whole settlement. They paid my client, they paid his client, and they even paid his client's insurance company that had paid them a little money.
Mr. Myrick, unless I misunderstood your opening statement, I thought you indicated that your client gave the insurance company the go-ahead. Did I misunderstand you?
Well, it was 3 weeks after the mediation that they told their insurance company, that they told their lawyer and the lawyer told the insurance company that they were going to settle this case. But they wouldn't sign, but you can't, they couldn't settle that way because the statute precludes them from settling that way. And they can't claim estoppel because the mediation agreement, the refusal to sign the closing documents, and the statute, that's another point I want to make, is the statute, you cannot claim justifiable reliance when you know that what you're doing violates the terms of a statute. The statute said it's got to be either in court or subscribed to in writing by the attorney or the client. They didn't have that here. So I think I forgot to ask. What was your question?
Well, just going to the fact that, at least from your opening statement, it was your client that told the insurance company. This goes to the estoppel argument, not the statutory argument. Your client told the insurance company to go ahead and settle. Now, if that is, in fact, the case, then why doesn't estoppel lie here?
Well, one thing is because it's not, I'm claiming it's not justifiable because there was a verbal statement, right, that's true. But then the closing statement, then they changed their mind again. And they changed it relatively soon. Right after they made this statement, we're going to settle, the closing documents came out and they refused to sign. That goes to the issue of detriment. How is there a detriment to this company by my clients refusing to, they cite that Milas case where they went through a 9-month arbitration, and it was contested. And then right at the end of it, then the city said, well, sorry, this doesn't count. And the city lost. And then the city said, sorry, this doesn't count because the very contract that the arbitration was based on was expired. And they're trying to equate our case with that case. In that case, it was a 9-month contested arbitration. In our case, they attended a mediation that lasted a few hours, and then they were told it was off by the client not signing in 24 hours. Then they were told it was on 3 weeks later. Then they were, in a sense, told it was off weeks after that when my client refused to sign. Now, they claim there's two ways they were deprived in this agreement. One is because they had all this discovery, which they say is wasted. But if we get to start the case again, they can use all the discovery again. And the other thing they say they're deprived of are their defenses, where my client, and that's in the decision in the circuit court, and I think it's in the Court of Appeals, where they say my client tried to have its cake and eat it too, where they said, we want to start over again, but then there was a answer to a counterclaim written that you can't counterclaim because this case is settled, see. But we didn't write that reply to counterclaim. That was written by our insurance company who had to defend on various of their counterclaims. So my point is that they can use all their defenses, they can use all their discovery, and they're not prejudiced at all by starting this case over again.
Counsel, go ahead, Justice.
Well, I was just going to, initially I asked the question about the reliance. The defendant, how do you pronounce that?
Neosho.
Basically, they did rely in the sense they cast a check. There was no, you mentioned 3 weeks, but we had the argument about what, or the discussion about what the judge did here, but there was no notice, nothing, it was sort of laying fallow, so to speak, nothing was done. And you're saying that after 3 weeks they were on notice that it was not going to be a deal, if there was no settlement. Just tell me exactly what took place 3 weeks that was
Okay. Here's a scenario, was that there was a mediation, I think was May 21st. Then 3 weeks after that, my client calls his insurance company, his lawyer, says the case is settled, and the attorney calls the attorney for the insurance company. That attorney calls the attorney for the defendant.
But that's the point, but the case was settled.
Okay, but the insurance company starts sending out, they send out checks. And before any releases are signed, they send out checks. And they send out the releases and they send out the stipulation in order for dismissal immediately after this 3-week period. Everybody signs except the plaintiff. The plaintiff's attorney doesn't sign and the plaintiff doesn't sign. And if their check was cashed, I submit it's the problem of the insurance company that sends out checks before they have releases signed. My client sent back the check. They sent back all the money. So,
They did that 3 weeks later, is that what you're saying? When did they do that?
They did it quite a while later.
Well, the point I'm making, or trying to make, probably not very well, is that you said after 3 weeks everybody knew it wasn't a done deal. I'm saying I didn't see that, and that's what I was asking.
Okay, I'm saying that once they send out the releases, they send out the checks, and they send out the stipulation in order for dismissal, and the plaintiff does not sign. And then there's even letters in the record going from the insurance company to the plaintiff. You know, we sent out, I thought this case is settled. Let's sign, and there's no signature. And then even after the judge dismissed the case without prejudice, there's still letters going out. We need these releases signed because they knew that this case could come back again if those releases and stipulations were not signed.
Could I ask you a couple of factual questions?
Sure.
Who is Janice Hafercorn?
Janice Hafercorn is the wife of the president of Affordable Erecting, and his name is Tracy Haffercorn.
Okay. Does Janice work for Affordable?
Yes.
Does she have, is she an officer?
I think she is an officer.
Okay. Now, according to Mr. Eckert's affidavit, Janice told the attorney.
Yes.
For, and then the attorney told Acuity. Is that right?
Right. That's correct.
All right. Now, was it just stupidity on the part of Acuity to accept her representation that this case had been settled?
It wasn't stupidity. It was their desire to get this case settled. That's why they sent out checks before releases were signed.
All right. Now, they sent out a check for $3,500 to Affordable. Is that correct?
Right. Right.
And what happened to that check?
That check was held in the trust account of Affordable's first attorney until I got involved in the case. Then he sent that check to me, and then I sent it back to Acuity.
So for months, they kept the check?
Yeah.
What inference is drawn from that?
I suppose it's an inference that the inference of that, together with the fact that he wouldn't sign a stipulation in order for dismissal, goes to the fact that he was there was an indecision about whether to settle the case. But I would say, well, of course, the argument of estoppel goes to whether they could justifiably rely that the case was settled, and also whether there was detriment here. And I'm saying they lose on both accounts. One is because they were thinking that this case was settled in violation of this statute. See, I think the statute can also be used on the estoppel argument.
Go ahead.
Sir, give me an argument that isn't technical, but why it is just plain fair that you should win.
Okay. Because they haven't lost anything. We can start all over again. We're in the same place we were when this case was first started. They've done all their discovery. They have all their defenses. And we can just go to trial, and they haven't lost anything. I don't see how it's fair to deprive. See, they've got my client's got a $17,500 claim. The insurance company wanted, and they agreed on this mediation to settle our claim for $3,500 on the basis that their client was going broke. And now this client has proceeded to get up to the Supreme Court and have one of the most expensive law firms there is, and they're still not broke.
Well, maybe they will be.
That's right.
They may be. Do not know it.
We're going to hold this case over for next year. We'll see what we can do.
Counsel, I expected you to argue that this is a summary judgment case. Isn't it?
You mean on our behalf, for us?
It was a summary judgment, and that the facts of reliance, reasonable reliance, and the facts of detriment just weren't shown, and that you're still disputing that.
Well, if they're not shown, then it gives us the right to start over again.
Yes.
So that you mean that the trial court should have just given us the right to start over again?
Well, the trial court should have at least heard evidence before it summarily decided on affidavits that there was equitable estoppel. You should have had a hearing with evidence on equitable estoppel. You're saying here there's no detriment. You're saying here that the reliance was unreasonable. These are factual issues. When did you ever bring in testimony?
I didn't.
No, and no one else did either on that issue.
I did
point
out.
Disputed facts.
Right.
If they're disputed facts.
I did point out that I disagreed with several of the facts in the trial court's brief.
And most of those went to trial court's decision. Most of that went to 80705 as to whether or not there was ever an agreement under 80705. If I read it right, the trial court seemed to think sometimes that there was an agreement that fit 80705 and other times that there wasn't a signed agreement. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I thought you were going to argue.
I know what I disagreed with was where the trial court kept mixing up what the plaintiff did with what the plaintiff's insurer did. She said the plaintiff signed the settlement agreement, and the plaintiff in the same breath attempts to dismiss counterclaims regarding the original claims in the present action, asserting that the parties reached a full settlement and released all claims in the prior action. In short, the plaintiff seeks to have its cake and eat it.
Well, the court could have been doing exactly what you have said it has did. Or it could have said, well, look, Attorney Eckert's signature is there. The only thing is that there is a, quote, a contingency. That's what the court missed. The court missed relating to the contingency, which you base your argument on, that, look, it had one day to resolve this. You didn't get the okay from Tracy, and therefore the deal is off. That's the argument.
That's correct.
Following up on that, I mean, this seems to me to be a continuing, it made a record reflect, continuing problems in the foundation is difficult. But the difficulty of the infirmity of the foundation, as I understand it, is this. The trial court, as I recall, found compliance with the statute and did that on an erroneous fact. The trial court found compliance with the statute in that the trial court thought, just like you said, that the plaintiff, not the plaintiff's insurer, the attorney, the plaintiff signed it. The plaintiff did not sign it. That's why the trial court could find compliance with the statute. The Court of Appeals looks at it and says, huh, you know, they got this a little wrong, the plaintiff didn't sign it, so we can't find compliance with the statute, so we're going to go do it on equitable estoppel. But it doesn't seem, this is following up on the Chief, it doesn't seem to me that the trial court really got to, was there reasonable reliance, which is usually a question of fact, and was there detriment, which was usually a question of fact. Because of the erroneous fact upon which the trial court relied. And so, I mean, it seems to me, why doesn't this case go back for the development of the facts as to reasonable reliance and detriment? Maybe it shouldn't. I'm just throwing this out.
That's one way to look at it. In my opinion, I don't think they could show reasonable reliance, and I don't think they can show detriment, but rather than, you know, getting an adverse decision, I would certainly pick going back to the trial court.
I'm looking at Mr. Bogart's brief in Appendix 175, and this once again goes to the estoppel argument. And this is your affirmative defense. And it doesn't highlight the insurance company. This is the affirmative defense for affordable. And it says, as for a second affirmative defense, plaintiff alleges the defendant's counterclaims 3 and 4 are barred by accord and satisfaction since defendant signed an agreement and cashed a settlement check for the alleged damages. Defendant's claims have been released. It seems that you are relying on the very agreement for purposes of the affirmative defense that you say doesn't exist for purposes of your claims.
See, I never wrote that counterclaim. It was the insurance. See, they say plaintiff, and there were two replies to the counterclaim that came in. One was by me, the counterclaims 1 and 2. The other was by the insurance company, Acuity, the counterclaims 3 and 4. But they don't differentiate. They say plaintiff did this, and that's what the circuit judge did.
This is signed by attorneys Bogart, Powell, Peterson, and Frown, by Barbara O'Brien,
right,
and for affordable, not by
right, but okay, but She represents the insurance company. She was paid by the insurance company. She didn't follow any directions from Affordable. She acted on the advice. See, that goes along with the idea that the insurance company wanted to say that this case was settled. So when they say, and they didn't support the plaintiff when the plaintiff was opposing the settlement. They want the case settled, and in their counterclaim they said, the case is settled, therefore you don't have these counterclaims. But they certainly weren't acting on behalf of their insured when they said that.
The insured had its own counsel?
Yes. And, of course, what confuses the issue is that they never entered the case as a party. The only insurance company that entered the case as a party was Neosho's insurance company, General Casualty, which there was another heading to this case in the original case. They had Affordable versus Neosho, and then it was General Casualty was in a second heading, but they're not a part of this. They were also paid off in this mediation settlement. It was $12,500. Affordable got $3,500, Neosho got $5,000, and I think a General Casualty got $4,000.
Suppose you win. The win you want is that it just go to trial as to your claim for the $18,000, roughly $18,000. What happens with all these other checks that were passed? Would that just be a set-off against anything that you might win?
There could be a court order, I suppose, that they have to return the money, or it could await the final settlement to see what happens and whether money's got to go back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But in other words, you can reach all the parties in your lawsuit, everyone that got money.
Yeah, there's us, we returned our money, and so that there's just Neosho got $5,000, and I believe their insurance company got $4,000. Yeah, thank you.
General Casualty is not here.
General Casualty is not here, but Acuity is here in the interest.
No, I don't mean present in the court. I mean in the lawsuit, in this present lawsuit, this second lawsuit.
They were in a heading, and they did appear by counsel. So
but now
they've been dropped off the heading for some reason. But I think
they appeared in trial court in your lawsuit.
Yes, they were at that mediation. They were at the mediation.
I know that. I'm talking about your second lawsuit. This is the second lawsuit, right?
Right.
If they're not in, I wonder. That's my point.
I know.
If they're not in the lawsuit, how in the world are they going to get? The judge just can't send a letter saying return your money.
That would require another lawsuit unless they were present in this lawsuit.
Unless
the judge can try that.
Unless they return the money voluntarily, I think they could be sued on the basis that they got the money.
Might be another lawsuit.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bogart, representing Neosho Trompler.
Chief Justice Abramson, may it please the court. The thing I think I'd like to clear up first is the 80705 argument. I believe Justice Bradley was discussing an erroneous fact found by the trial court. I don't think the trial court erred here, Your Honor. The mediation agreement was signed by Philip Eckert for Affordable Erecting, Inc. 80705 only requires that a settlement be reduced to writing and signed by a party or its counsel. Philip Eckert was counsel for Affordable Erecting when he signed this agreement.
Well, who added to the mediation agreement? There's a little asterisk, but I don't see where there's an asterisk in the upper part of the agreement.
I believe you'll find it right behind Affordable Erecting's name, Your Honor. Up in the first
line. All right. So whoever signed for Affordable said, quote, settlement contingent on approval from Tracy Hapricorn, right?
Correct.
So the council that signed for affordable erecting as a condition was not signing away saying, I'm agreeing with this on behalf of my client. They were saying, I'm agreeing if my client later agrees.
That's true, Your Honor. This court's decision in the Kosinski case speaks to that. This court's decision in Kosinski had the same situation. There were letters from opposing counsel verifying the terms of a settlement subscribed by each counsel, and both letters acknowledged that since the city of Milwaukee was involved in the settlement and the lawsuit, that it was contingent upon approval by the city common council. This court found that the formal requirements of 80705 were met by the letters and subscription. And then the second issue became, is this an enforceable settlement agreement under contract law principles? So 80705 can be met with contingencies attached to the signatures as long as that contingency is met. And that's what happened here. By Affordable's own affidavits from its own counsel, which it adopted as its facts in its briefs to this court, the Affordable approved the settlement, ratifying the mediation agreement and adopting the signature of their attorney. Now,
but when did they approve?
Well, by Mr. Eckert, we only know this because of Mr. Eckert's affidavit, Your Honor. Obviously, we couldn't be in the room when he was talking to his client, but he claims 3 weeks later that approval was granted by his client. Now,
for purposes of 80705, which calls for an agreement to be signed by the parties or by counsel, right on the face of that agreement, it says settlement contingent on approval from Tracy Happercorn by May 22nd at 12 p.m. Now, if that didn't occur, do you not need, for purposes of 80705, a new agreement that deals with the contingency that's missing?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. The May 22nd deadline was not a deadline. It was aspirational. It was a goal. It was an attorney who didn't have his counsel at the mediation trying to relieve everybody's anxiety about the fact that he would go to his client quickly about this. What everyone understood the contingency to be was approval of his client.
Once again, we get into that distinction between what the parties meant and what they said. The agreement says settlement contingent on approval by a particular time. Now, for purposes of 80705, and just dealing with that statute, it seems that that did not take place. And if that did not take place, do you not, once again, need a new agreement if you're going to satisfy the statute?
Your Honor, since all the other parties did not consider that to be a drop-dead date, the approval still had the effect of adopting this mediation agreement as the signed agreement that settled this case. And in fact, if you look at the conduct of the parties, why would Affordable approve a settlement that no longer existed?
Isn't the problem here, counsel, and the confusion is that under 80705, it's either signed, it's by the attorney or the client. Here you have the contingency, as Justice Butler mentioned, but the problem is that then you have I don't want to say a change of mind, but you have an attorney, Eckert, who has an affidavit saying that he received information from an officer who purportedly, we won't get into that, but that of the company who said that it's okay, and he at least thought it was settled. So the attorney for counsel's client said he thought it was settled, and then there is the inaction of nothing going on. So that's what I think Justice Butler raises a very good point. The problem with it is that where does this so-called aspirational date drop off? Is it something that exists forever, or should there have been a time, a reasonable time? That's the difficulty that I think the court has, at least I have, with the contingency.
I understand, Your Honor. 3 weeks is not an unreasonable time for them to approve. And it's indisputable that they approved this settlement. That's their own facts, their own affidavits submitted and adopted as part of their brief here.
You say they.
Affordable Erecting, I'm sorry.
Okay. The plaintiff Affordable Erecting.
Yes. I'll try to be more clear.
If it's undisputed, and I'm just pushing this if I may, if it's undisputed they accepted it, then why didn't they ever sign a release or cash the check? Sounds to me like they must dispute it.
I think at best they had a change of heart several weeks and perhaps months later. In the meantime, allowed all the other parties to perform under this settlement agreement to their detriment. But that goes to estoppel more than the 80705 analysis, obviously.
Counselor, do you think that it's possible to have a change of heart and comply with the statute?
I'm sorry, I don't follow you.
You're using the written mediation agreement as the written document that you argue to us complies with the statute. And then you said, well, that's the agreement, but they had a change of heart. And I guess my question to you is, then does the statute allow for a change of heart, or rather not allow for a change of heart? Once you've signed the document, then you can't have a change of heart.
Well, once you sign the document, if it's contingent as this one was,
right,
certainly you have to meet the contingency, and it's our argument that the contingency was met despite that date unilaterally put on it by Affordable's counsel. You cannot have a change of heart once you've approved or met the contingency, because then the settlement ripens into an enforceable settlement, and a change of heart is known as a breach.
Okay, so you're telling me that you have the mediation agreement, it's contingent. The contingency is released by a statement from a person authorized to so release the contingency without any concern about, I should have done this 3 weeks ago. And at that point in time, then the statute clicks in, and that's the end of it. You can't change your mind again.
I guess I would suggest that it's contract law that clicks in to say you can't change your mind.
I want to keep you in the statute, because that's what you're telling me this document satisfies, and I've got to get it in my head about how is it satisfying the statute.
Well, the statute is a statute of fraud, and my understanding is its purpose is to simply assure the court that the terms of the agreement are not in dispute. No one disputes the terms of this agreement. It was reduced to writing, signed, no one disputes it, and even Affordable has argued that they've made a new offer based on the exact same terms at some point.
Well, let's just go back a bit. If you're telling me that I'm going to look at the four squares of this document, I understand that. It's a contingent settlement that may comply with the statute, okay? But the contingency was removed orally.
Correct.
Is that in any way a problem with the statute as far as you're concerned?
No, because...
Okay. All right, I'm going to stop right there. Okay, so now we've got the contingency removed orally, and that's no problem. At the point that it's removed, is the statute satisfied and no party can change their position?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I was
saying. Why?
Mm-hmm. Right. That was my next question.
Why?
Because at the point where the contingency was met, this became an enforceable agreement and no party could back out. The approval was made and everyone was agreed to be bound by the terms of this agreement.
Well, did everybody know, in other words, when I read the contingency, settlement contingent on approval from Tracy
Heffercorn.
What I, that's why the, I question the attorney, the former counsel, was allegedly informed, and he put an affidavit form that he thought it was approved because he got word that it was.
Correct. He was instructed by his client that they approved the settlement, and he's put that in a sworn affidavit.
Yes.
And who did he tell?
He told Acuity's counsel because Acuity was the only party that had to perform under this agreement. They were going to cut checks.
But everybody else was not told.
They were told through Acuity in a letter that said this case has been settled. Here are the checks. Here is a more formal settlement agreement and mutual release. A letter that was also received by Affordable's counsel and was never questioned or challenged by Affordable or its counsel, and everyone performed based on that letter.
So the letter that was received by Affordable's counsel went out 3 weeks from the – when did that go out?
I understand, immediately after Acuity's attorney was told by Affordable's attorney that his client approved the settlement, which set into motion I think the reason he told Acuity was that's who had to perform.
The reliance was based on the fact that the letter was sent to Eckhart and or his client. I don't know if that's true, but at least he got one and there was no response.
Exactly. There was silence. And there was no refusal, so to speak, to sign the settlement agreement by Affordable. No one stated on behalf of Affordable, we refuse to sign this more formal document submitted by Acuity. There was silence.
The only thing that concerns me is that the statute says it can be signed either by the client or by counsel.
Correct.
There was a contingency. This was signed by counsel, and counsel was then told 3 weeks later that it was an agreement.
Correct.
Okay. But actually, there was a mind change here at some point in time, and you don't know when that was, because if Eckhart thought there was a signed deal, why wouldn't he not return? That was the signal there. He didn't return the release. He didn't return the, when he received the letter from the insurance company. Excuse me. There was no response from Eckhart.
That's correct. And then Attorney Eckhart did not respond to the court either when the court gave him notice of a dismissal, all consistent with the fact that the case had been resolved.
Well, if it had been resolved under that mediation agreement, why did you need all this extra paperwork?
Well, Acuity's idea, I believe. It wasn't needed. If you look at the mediation agreement, it states that it's final and binding and enforceable by a court.
You just file it in court and ask for a dismissal and you're home free. You don't need any of this other stuff. I suggest that it was all done because it's shaky. They don't approve it by May 22, 2003, noon. There's oral communication among some of the parties, some of the individuals involved, that, well, they're going to approve it anyway. Then there's a communication that they're not going to approve it. And none of this is in writing. None of these later communications are in writing. So you've got the only written document has a proviso, has a condition. It's never removed in writing. And the whole point about 807.05 seems to be you get it in writing and you do it in open court where there is a record. So you don't have these kind of fights. So why should we say here in this case, this satisfies 807.05, when the whole goal, at least a significant goal as I see it, is to save these fights and not get into this mess?
I'd have to go back to the court's decision in Kosinski, which I...
In Kosinski, you had two people agreeing. The second person is the Milwaukee City and its insurance company. So they take it to the council. In the interim, Kozinski backs out.
Correct.
And the city says, whoa, I reserve the right, city, I reserve the right to back out. You didn't reserve that right. You're bound, Mr. Kozinski, until I, the city, make up my mind. Sort of the opposite of this case. The court held in Kozinski, as I read the opinion, the court held Kozinski did not make an offer that was irrevocable. Kozinski made an offer that I'll settle with the city at such and such a price. The city accepts it. The city didn't promptly accept it. And Kozinski says, I'm withdrawing my offer. And the court says, under contract law, when I make an offer and you don't accept it, I can withdraw it. Kozinski's not like this case.
Well, it is like this case from the aspect that the contingency here gave Affordable the opportunity to back out, and it didn't. It approved. Its own attorney has filed a sworn affidavit to that effect. It approved. And the contingency doesn't require writing.
The weakness of that is it didn't approve it in writing or on a court record. And that's required under 80705. So what you got under 80705 is a mediation agreement that's not final. Anyway, that's the issue.
Let's say, just for argument purposes, that this mediation agreement does not comply with 80705. I know that it's your position that it does, but let's say it doesn't. If it is to be enforced under equitable estoppel, I asked this question to your opposing counsel. Is it necessary to remand? It seems to me that normally it would be, that you need the question of whether or not there was reasonable reliance on a mediation agreement like this, and then maybe detriment too, but more reasonable reliance is a question of fact. This was summary judgment, and that it should be remanded so that people can say, it was reasonable for me to rely on this even though it was a contingency and there was nothing in writing that, formalized it. It was reasonable for me to agree on, it was reasonable for me to rely on it even though they didn't cash the check or sign the release. And maybe it is reasonable, but I'm just saying, isn't that, the circuit court didn't do that because the circuit court, at least from my read of the circuit court's opinion, and I understand there's a different read, at least let's say it's ambiguous, maybe give me that. So why not remand? What's wrong with remand, assuming, and I know that's a big assumption, but if it's found that it doesn't comply with the requirements of 80705, don't you need to remand it for reasonable reliance determination?
Because reasonable reliance is shown in the affidavit of Affordable's counsel affidavit. What we had was a statement by Acuity's counsel that we have a settlement based on the approval received from counsel for Affordable Erecting, sending out the checks.
The checks were sent out before I keep on hearing that 3 weeks later the attorney for Affordable was notified that there was a settlement. The dates here are the settlement agreement was signed May 21 and June 4th the checks were sent out. So that's less than 3 weeks. Maybe the 3 weeks is really 2 weeks. But everyone says, and what I've read is 3 weeks. And if it's 3 weeks, that's more time than May 22nd or 21st, whatever date you want to use, until June 4th. That's a two-week period. So what happened first?
Based on the affidavit itself, in chronological order, approval, then checks issued. I mean, they don't put a date on when they approved it. They approximate 3 weeks, say approximately 3 weeks, but they do state that it was he received approval from his client, communicated that to Attorney O'Brien. Attorney O'Brien issued checks. And
I mean, it seems to me that that sounds in some ways very reasonable, even though there may arguably not be compliance with the statute. I mean, can't you know, attorney's word is the bond, you know all that stuff. But, but on the other hand, knowing that the thing smells a little bit to begin with, you're not sure that there was actual approval from Tracy Heffercorn as required here, and Dahl, I have to be careful, and Jeepers Christmas. the thing was never signed, and you knew there was some reticence, and it was never signed and never cashed. So maybe, just maybe, it wasn't quite as reasonable. I mean, maybe it was very reasonable, but it seems to me there needs to be some weighing of this someplace.
Well, I think the trial court looked at all the facts and did weigh them, and maybe it's not expressed well in the decision, but it had the facts of not only the actions I just spoke to you about, but the non-action by Affordable in the face of receiving a letter saying, this case is settled, here are the checks. What does it do? It holds on to the check for months. It doesn't tell anyone that, no, what are you talking about? We don't have a settlement here. We've got to start from square one if we really want a settlement here. No, they said nothing. They allowed the parties to cash the check, which brought up the accordance satisfaction arguments by Affordable and Acuity or whoever they claim was doing it. So bad non-action. They allowed the court to dismiss the case. They made no attempt to show good cause as to why it shouldn't have been. And, in fact, from the trial court's decision, they called the court. The plaintiff's attorney called the court and said, we've got a stipulation. We'll file it. We'll check on the status for you. And that happened on June 25th of 2003, a full month after the mediation agreement, a full month after they claimed that Neosho should have known that by lapse of the May 22nd date, there was no deal. Yet they're telling the court, we've got a settlement. Why else would they say that to the court? Wouldn't the message to the court have been, look, we weren't able to resolve this through mediation. We'll need a trial date, Judge. No. They told the court, they let all the parties believe through their non-action that the case had settled. And they have not challenged any of the findings of the trial court here.
Could I please follow up Justice Bradley's question? The check in the record here seems to be dated May 29th, 2003.
I don't know when Acuity actually cut the check. They didn't release it until June 4th.
Didn't release it until June 4th.
Right. There was a letter that they sent it to.
And did the letter go to Affordable at the same time?
Yes.
So they had the check in hand for $3,500, and then Janice Heffercorn talked to counsel, Mr. Eckert, is that right?
I can't speak for what Acuity was doing behind the scenes, but the chronology, I believe, is as you've pointed out. I think what probably happened is Acuity was prepared to perform immediately as soon as it received approval from Affordable. And once it received it, that's when it released the checks.
What's the significance in that check which just says present for payment within 60 days? Some companies will not honor a check if not presented within the time period set forth in the check.
That's true.
So at 60 days from May 29th, everybody knows they got a little problem, or at least Acuity knows it's got a major problem. Check isn't cashed. The stipulation is not signed.
I think Your Honor, it's correct when you say Acuity may have known that. Neosho, none of the other parties knew that. Nothing was communicated to Neosho.
Here's one of the problems, because there hasn't been communication in this with all the parties. It was only communication, according to the affidavit, with one attorney representing one entity. So who has to be given notice here? Insurance company or Neosho?
Well, for purposes of simply performing the agreement, Acuity was the one who needed to know, because Acuity had to release the checks.
But the Neosho has to cash it to show it's still in compliance, because under Kosinski, Neosho could have backed out.
Do you mean Neosho Affordable? I'm sorry.
I mean your client could have backed out if they wanted to. Because until Affordable accepted it, Kosinski said the other side can back out. They want to.
But Neosha's understanding was it was accepted at that point, and that's why they cashed it.
Who told Neosho?
Acuity forwarded that message to them, and Affordable did not disabuse anyone of that message.
Is that in writing anywhere?
No, Your Honor.
No, it's not. Okay.
Other than the affidavit of Mr. Eckert.
The affidavit of Eckert says he only told Acuity.
Acuity's loyal. Acuity, that's true.
Did Acuity have an agreement with Affordable that it would act as its attorneys in this matter?
I can't answer that question, Your Honor. I don't know what the relationship was. I do know that Attorney O'Brien later in this second action appeared on behalf of Affordable, and that's where the accord and satisfaction arguments were raised. And that's really the detriment here, Your Honor, as far as Neosha's reliance here. They cashed the check. They're now having to fend off a defense of accord and satisfaction. Acuity's not in the case and says they're done. They don't have Acuity to look to right now. Even if they could pursue their counterclaims against Affordable, we don't know if Affordable is good for the money, and we've lost something in any event because there's that second deeper pocket that may be lost now.
Well, you could have brought them in this lawsuit. You could have brought in Acuity. You could have brought in general casualty. Everybody could have been brought in.
True, but we're in a far worse position with respect to Acuity because of our reliance on Affordable's actions and non-actions in this case. Now, with respect to 80503, I think Justice Butler mentioned that, and our argument is simply that the case should have been dismissed with prejudice under 80503. It's clear under the statute. There was no attempt to show cause, and there was no attempt, and there was no mention in the court's decision that cause was shown, and therefore, by operation of that statute, it should have been with prejudice, and that would preclude this second case from having been filed.
You didn't go in and open that judgment, though.
No, we did not, nor did Affordable. Affordable chose to file in a different county, a separate action.
Are there any facts of record that Tracy ever approved the stipulation?
That Tracy Heffercorn himself, there's nothing in the record that states that Tracy Heffercorn himself approved the settlement. Janice Heffercorn was the messenger of the statement that Affordable Erecting did approve the settlement.
I read that affidavit. I mean, it's kind of covering both. The affidavit is clear that Tracy and avers Tracy mm-hmm. never signed or never approved the settlement. Let me see if I have that right word right. That, yes, number 7. Tracy Heffercorn never approved the settlement. And then number 8, and then that talks about approximately three weeks after the mediation conference, Janice Heffercorn said. Right. So it's...
I will submit to you that Affordable has told us that that really doesn't matter because they've continually stated in their briefing to this court that Affordable did, in fact, approve. What they're saying is we didn't approve in time, and therefore
that means that the settlement agreement doesn't take effect. Otherwise, I think you'd open the door to a lot of gamesmanship about what corporate officer should have approved what, and
well,
we certainly didn't have the ability at the time to find out what Tracy Hipperkorn was telling his counsel.
Well, of course, the little note at the bottom didn't say that the corporation had to approve. It said Tracy had to approve. If it had said the corporation has to approve, then you'd have an issue of who had authority to approve on behalf of the corporation. But it didn't say that. It said a particular person had to approve.
And we don't know if he approved or not based on this record, because Janice may have been communicating.
Oh, you do know, because the only affidavit you have says he didn't. That's what the
Attorney Eckert states.
But the issue that you argue is it's, you know, it isn't absolute reliance, it's reasonable reliance.
Exactly.
With regard to the estoppel. That's
yes.
Different with regard to 80705.
Exactly.
Any other questions? Hearing none, thank you very much, Mr. Goldberg, for your argument. Mr. Meyerhoff?
One thing I want to say is that when counsel talks about the detriment, he talked about the fact that now his client is precluded from offering the counterclaims, which Acuity is saying that they can't make because the case is settled. Well, if you rule that the case is not settled, then all of those arguments against them making counterclaims based on the fact is settled, they go out the window. They can make any counterclaims they want, and they have no detriment at all.
Counselor, I think what he's saying is because they took and kept Acuity's money, there's been accord and satisfaction. I don't think it has to do with settlement. They have Acuity's money in their pocket, and I think that's the basis for his argument.
No, well, they don't have Acuity's money in their pocket.
They don't. Don't they?
No.
Didn't they keep the checks and
no.
cash them?
No. They gave it back.
I'm not talking about Affordable. I'm talking about Neosho. They didn't give the money back, did they?
No, they didn't.
Well, see, I think his argument is not really that there was a settlement or not. It's the detriment on estoppel is that they kept the money. They kept it in good faith at the time they got the cash, the check, and they kept it. And now they're kind of stuck in trying to do any kind of direct action against Acuity because Acuity's going to say, hey, we paid you guys. And they don't know if Affordable is solvent, so they're saying that they just don't have the choices for payment. And that's what I think he's saying in regard to the detriment.
All right, yeah. But I'm saying that if there's a ruling here that there is no settlement, then there could also be a ruling that the monies have to be returned.
If that's ever challenged.
Yeah.
Ms. Meyerhoff, with respect to the 80705 argument, I want to pose a hypothetical for you. With respect to the contingency, let's say for sake of argument only that Tracy Hipperkorn had indeed contacted his lawyers prior to May 22, 2003 at noon or 12 p.m. and indicated, I approve the settlement. Is it your position that his indication that he approves the settlement that is subsequently communicated to the other parties would have to be in writing, or does the signature signed by counsel here, is that sufficient for purposes of 80705?
It would have to be in writing because the specific terms of 80705 say it's got to be in writing, subscribed to by either an attorney or the party.
But you have it in writing. You have it in writing that there's an agreement, is subject to a contingency which is approved, and that contingency is met. My question is, does the contingency, the fact that the contingency has been met, in addition, have to be in writing? You've already got a signed agreement. I think your quibble on 80705 is that that wasn't done in time. But had it been done in time, is it still your contention that that contingency would also have to be shown in writing?
Yes, because the subscribe means signed. And unless you have to sign off on a contingency, I think this came up during counsel's argument. What is the reason for 807.05? It's so that these disputes don't come up. So, see, if there was no signature, he could say, I didn't approve, or I did approve, or I did it contingent on something else. That's why, like in real estate cases, you know, where you have offers to purchase, everything has got to be in writing. It is a statute of frauds, and it's got to be in writing.
Of course, this was signed by counsel.
Right.
I think that's what Justice Butler's saying. This was signed. What you're saying is, well, it had to be signed also by Tracy. It
has to be signed again to remove the contingency to satisfy 807.05. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meyerhoff. Thank you, Mr. Bogart, for your arguments today in this case relating to 807.05. This concludes our hearing on 04-AP-2746, Affordable Electing, Inc. versus Neosha Trumpler, Inc. The students may remain. Justice Butler will be out shortly to talk with you. And we will be back here at 1:30 to hear our third case today.
Not much time to eat.